Welcome to Nature Revisited, the podcast. My name is Stefan Van Norden. And on this episode, I am thrilled to be joined by Rosanna Shaw to talk about her new book, California Against the Sea. Rosanna is an environmental reporter for the LA Times, where she specializes in reporting about the relationship between the coast and the ocean. Rosanna is a Pulitzer Prize finalist and has been featured in the Best American Science and Nature Writing series. In her book, not only does Rosanna bring her journalistic and historical perspective to the subject, but also brings a poet's voice to this very difficult relationship. California Against the Sea. Rosanna, thank you for joining me today on Nature Revisited to talk about your new book, California Against the Sea. People often say that what happens in America usually happens first in California. And that seems to be true even with climate change. But first, let's start with what led you to become an environmental journalist and your interest and passion for the ocean and the California coastline?
Yeah, hi, Stefan. It's such an honor to be on your podcast today. And I really appreciate your question because this is something that I actually stopped reflecting on and asking myself years ago. And I've been rethinking and re-reflecting a lot on this question since my book came out. You know, so many people have assumed that I surf, grew up loving the beach, you know, I'm a water baby, but, you know, I'll be honest, I don't remember the first time I saw the ocean and just this assumption that I had this like intrinsic connection to the ocean. You know, I grew up in Massachusetts too, so I'm not even from California. In Massachusetts, like privatized beaches are very much a thing. To go to the beach in Massachusetts, you need to know someone who knows someone who has a house on Cape Cod or at Martha's Vineyard, and you know, access to the beach is just not the same as what it is in California. To have a connection with the ocean in a way that just feels so inseparable from your identity, that is something that I really started to learn and feel and embrace and embody the longer I lived in California. I do consider myself a late bloomer on kind of the coastal front and just really understanding and appreciating and respecting kind of the wonders of the ocean. But I think this late to life relationship with the coast had made my appreciation for the California coast so much deeper, much more wide ranging. And I feel like my love for the coast is almost this accumulation of meeting so many people in California who do have these stories, these origin stories of why they fell in love with the ocean and what the coast means to them. I feel like it's been truly a privilege to write about these stories, to meet these people, and to get to know the coast through so many people and their memories and their connections to this really stunning landscape.
So what inspired you to write California Against the Sea, and how has it been received?
I'll start by saying that I feel so lucky to be an environmental reporter at the LA Times that only has to focus on coastal and ocean issues. At the LA Times, our environment reporters are each assigned a specialized focus, whether it's water or wildfires or air quality or extreme weather or environmental justice. For years, I would write what would be considered kind of the more old school approach to newspaper writing. Those stories would make a big splash for the day. It's on the front page. It would become one of the most read articles on the LA Times website. But then, like, you know, I wake up the next day and people move on to the next big headline. In the same way, a disaster sadly wipes out a community. The sun comes out the next day and another disaster happens somewhere elsewhere. People move on to the next news cycle. You know, people tend to remember the stories you tell them, not necessarily the data. And people tend to remember how they feel rather than the facts that trigger those feelings. I was coming at this topic of sea level rise and climate change from very much like a science reporter perspective, laying out the facts, laying out the numbers. At one point a few years ago, I just really realized my job is to also help people make meaning out of the data. So, you know, I really started to think about what it would take to possibly turn all of my reporting on sea level rise into a book. I just really felt like there was an entire book to be written about California. And I mean, if you think about the coastline, it's more than 1,200 miles long from the Oregon border all the way to Mexico. And there are like dozens of cities with different social histories and geologies and geographies. And I was trying to find the right editor and the right publisher who believed that a story about California could truly be a story that resonates with anyone who's interested in the future of our relationship to the ocean and how we adapt. Shout out to Heyday Books, this wonderful indie publisher based in Berkeley. Martina, my editor there, she was like, Rosanna, I want to publish the book that you think needs to be written, not the book that I think would sell. I want the conversation to start there. I'm so proud of the book that we have published because this is the book that I wish had existed when I first started covering the coast, when I first became an environmental reporter. And the feedback so far has been really inspiring. My biggest insecurity before we launched the book was wondering whether or not people outside of California would pick up this book and feel connected to it. The answer so far is that people do. I just had someone in Maryland write me the loveliest email saying this book took her on a road trip up and down the California coast that she had never expected. It took her beyond Santa Monica and Malibu and all these stereotypical images and notions to California, and that it made her think a lot about her own shoreline on the East Coast. Yeah, that's my hope with this book, that the story of California is the beginning of a deeper conversation about all of our relationship to the ocean.
So let's talk about that shoreline, the West Coast shoreline, which includes California. How different and unique is it, and how, in some ways, it's more susceptible to erosion than other coastlines?
That's a good question. The first thing you notice is, oh my God, there are cliffs. Cliffs that literally just plummet right into the sea. I mean, you don't really see that kind of landscape on the Atlantic coast. And everyone knows that California gets a lot of earthquakes. And that is truly because of these cliffs and just the fact that the California coast is literally the edge of just where two massive tectonic plates meet. So there's this constant grinding and pressure between these two plates and the seismic energy that forms all these stunning geological features that really make the California coast so iconic. As a reporter covering this very long and varied shoreline, I kind of break the landscape up into two different, very general categories. A community or a home in California on the coast is situated on top of a bluff or a cliff overlooking the ocean. And these cliffs used to be buffered by wide and sandy beaches at the bottom of the cliff. And those beaches are eroding and eroding and eroding over the years from sea level rise. So there's cliffs, and then the other kind of large grouping I have in my head is like wetlands and floodplains. We have in California built so many communities on top of filled in coastal wetlands. And some of these areas are below sea level, and our dune systems in California have been largely erased due to development and just our settlement patterns. I think the dune ecology is something that I have become fascinated with and something that I immediately try to seek out whenever I go back to New England.
So why are dunes, wetlands, and salt marshes so important to the coastal ecosystems?
One of the things I truly loved about the process of reporting for this book is really starting to recognize that we're not just talking about land and ocean, intersection between the two on the edge, right where land meets ocean, but also all these amazing, fascinating, almost magical intertidal spaces, these in-between spaces that are not truly land and not truly water. Wetlands, dune systems, salt marshes, mud flats, like all these systems are sometimes meant to be underwater and sometimes meant to be above water. And the amount of biodiversity, plant life, wildlife, the habitats they create is truly stunning. Because, and there's just something so magical and so powerful to be standing at this nexus point between land and ocean. And we have largely erased so much of this intertidal system for the sake of development. How do we respond to this? One really powerful kind of emerging movement is this idea of re-enlivening our shoreline, and to recognize that before we hardened our shoreline with development, with these hardened lines in the sand, there was this really cool buffer zone between land and ocean in the form of dunes, in the form of wetlands, in the form of salt marshes that can actually serve as a great natural buffer to the rising ocean. I think a really common reference point that I hear a lot in the science community is people will point to the dunes in New Jersey that protected a community from Superstorm Sandy and the swells that came in. Like, there was like a community nearby that experienced the same amount of flooding and water rise, but it was more flooded than the community that was backed by a rehabilitated dune system. So I think there is this really cool movement to basically reconnect and to, you know, reappreciate all of nature's existing wisdom along the shoreline when it comes to just providing natural protection and buffer from the rising ocean.
So how has some of the human factors helped to exacerbate this situation, such as seawalls, beach grooming, and introducing ice plants? Do people have to build a seawall to build a seawall to build a seawall?
Yeah, let's talk about seawalls. I think that's kind of the default, kind of that instinct response that folks have when they're like, oh my God, the ocean is moving inland. Let's build a wall to block off the ocean. But, you know, how realistic and how sustainable is that to try to block off the most massive body of water on this planet? It's mind-blowing to me how many people today, when I talk to them, still think of the coast as static, as this place that doesn't move. You know, you go to the beach and you expect everything to look exactly the same the next time you go back. In reality, the beach and the coast is actually a process. Sand is always moving. The tide line is always moving. Yet we have, the way we've built our environment, tried to impose permanence onto this inherently impermanent space. So the ways we have fixed our lines in the sand, so to speak, most predominantly with seawalls, for example, but also just like Pacific Coast Highway, our surf liner, the way we've built up some of our coastal beachfront communities, all of this is inherently challenging the fact that the coastline is supposed to move. And now that the ocean is rising, the ocean is moving in, the coastline is supposed to move with it, and we're supposed to move with it. That last part of the reality is the hard part. And what we've tried to do is to stop that movement by building a seawall. And as one a prominent environmentalist told me really bluntly, she said the hidden consequence of seawalls is that seawalls kill beaches. The minute you fix that line in the sand and if the water continues to move inland, what gets drowned out? Everything in front of that seawall. And so you basically lose the beach and you shift these natural erosion processes and the way you create sand in the first place and the way the beaches, the waves kind of bring in sand and spread the sand out on the beach, all of that gets lost the minute you build a hard structure trying to block this process. They're getting increasingly controversial in California and elsewhere around the world, but that still remains the number one de facto approach. You mentioned ice plant. Ice plant was another kind of quote unquote natural way to harden this line in the sand. It's an invasive species that can really populate super quickly. It was originally introduced as a way to possibly stabilize crumbling cliffs and sediment, but it's also turning out to be a really oppressive invasive species that's kind of monopolized and pushed out all other native species along the beach. The plants also get so heavy once they overpopulate an area that it sometimes even brings an entire cliffside down because it's made the cliff so heavy. We have become blinded to the fact that the shoreline is supposed to move. I should say, like, I was guilty of this too when I first started covering the coast and thinking that sea level rise was an infrastructure crisis. It was a disaster that we needed to defend ourselves again. But truly, if you think about what the actual disaster is, we are the disaster. We are in the way of the ocean. We have disrupted, again, like this amazing dance between land and ocean.
As we all know, this crisis along the coastline is nothing new. Can you take us through the process of how the Coastal Act of 1976 was enacted? And is it still strong enough to guide California into the future?
Yeah, thank you for this question. For folks listening to this podcast who aren't from California, I think a crash course in the Coastal Act would be think about the California coast and think about how accessible it is and how you can drive along the highway and literally see the entire coastline. There's not a single high rise that blocks your view. You know, I'll tell my friends, like, if you think about, for example, the Jersey Shore or Miami shoreline, California's coast just does not look like that. And it's because of this conscious law that was introduced by a voter initiative and truly passed by the people back in 1976, known as the Coastal Act. You know, back then, overwhelming majority of Californians kind of declared philosophically that the coast is this broader public good that cannot be privatized, that the coast cannot be owned by anyone. And so therefore, the coast belongs to everyone. You'll notice along the coastal highway, there are all these tiny little signs and staircases and alleyways that say coastal access, public beach access. And you can literally squeeze between two mega mansions and go down a set of stairs to go to the beach. Because again, there's no such thing as a private beach in California. And on top of that, I think in the context of sea level rise and what this means for the future, it's really interesting for me and really powerful to kind of recognize that we do have a framework that is both philosophical stand and also a legal framework to at least help people dealing with sea level rise today in California kind of understand what our priorities are. And the priority is to maintain the coast as a public good for the people. The Coastal Act, for example, is very clear on helping the Coastal Commission, the enforcers of the Coastal Act, you know, recognize where we should be putting our priorities. And so a lot of other states and even countries have studied this law and the spirit of this law. You can see in places like Hawaii and Maine and elsewhere. When this law was written, sea level rise and climate change was not something that was super front of mind or even clearly understood. And so the way I've been seeing the Coastal Act is that it is a living document, and it's been really inspiring to see how this law has continued to be interpreted and adapted to maintain this core mission in California that the beach is meant to be protected for everyone.
So do you see it as being strong enough to guide California into the future?
I do and I don't. I'm putting my reporter hat back on because as a journalist, you're kind of trained to see all sides of an issue, right? On the one hand, this is one of the strongest, most elegant environmental safeguards in the country. It's truly a law that has been modeled after by so many other places. On the other hand, I would say that a law is a law and a law is only as good as its enforcement. The California Coastal Commission is truly also one of the most powerful, you know, land use environmental protection agencies in the country. It's quasi-judicial. It's truly fascinating. It's also kind of one of the most intensely debated commissions. The cases that come before the Coastal Commission, every single meeting, it's just so high stakes. Talking about some of the most expensive real estate in the country. We're talking about so many things that people want out of the coast that is in conflict with each other, and to maintain this core mission of protecting the coast on behalf of the public is a really hard task. The Coastal Commission in its current form has been remarkably strong in champions of just the core mission. But that's something that, you know, we shouldn't take for granted. And on top of that, I just think that the Coastal Commission is also severely underfunded given the severity of their mission. The reality is there are a lot of really, really wealthy people along the coast who can afford to sue the commission and keep a lawsuit literally in perpetuity to keep their slice of paradise. I guess to summarize and to add one more beat to this, it provides such a strong framework how it is possible to collectively treat a landscape as varied but also cohesive as the California coastline and to think beyond jurisdictional boundaries and individual property lines. The Coastal Act firmly establishes this framework that is critical to the way we have to make decisions going into the future.
So let's shift just a little bit. Who are some of the Native people who are caught in this crisis? Are their voices beginning to emerge? And how are the rights of those Indigenous people connected to this crisis?
I think, again, just to start really broadly, the story of Native California is unique and often kind of overlooked in some ways from kind of the way we talk about Native history. The federally recognized tribes in California are, you know, few and far between relative to how many Native communities and tribes and tribal nations do exist in the state of California. And one of the first things I noticed when I started covering the California coast is, where are all the Indigenous people? They were first pushed out, but then they were priced out. Just recognizing that California Indigenous communities belong to this conversation about sea level rise and planning our coast for the future. What does it mean to also step back and think about the perspectives, the non-Western perspectives that could really guide some of these really sticky questions and discussions we've been having? The book opens with a Chumash story, and the Chumash are the Native people to what is now present day Santa Barbara and Malibu. You know, I was going on a walk with this member of the Chumash band, the coastal band of the Chumash Nation. And she's also a biologist by training and also a cultural educator for her community. She was able to kind of bring in knowledge what the people's relationship to the coast used to be before we decided to draw such firm lines into the sand. And so as an environmental reporter, we often rely on Western science and Western policy to guide and explain and give meaning to these conversations about planning for the future. There is this greater movement that I'm really encouraged by to bring Indigenous knowledge into these conversations, but so often they're still presented as an either or you'll read an environmental report and there's like a section buried 60 pages into the report that's on Indigenous knowledge, but it's not really in conversation with the rest of the science that's happening in that report. Part of my hope with this book was to start integrating Indigenous knowledge, Indigenous perspectives with Western science and having these forms of wisdom in conversation with each other rather than in parallel with each other. And for so long, we have not only not centered Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous perspectives, we have erased them from this conversation. And then even when we do bring in Indigenous perspectives, a lot of Indigenous leaders will tell me that the way we talk about Native Americans still often kind of, we put that into the past, like, oh, this used to be something like this. There's this over-romanticized notion of like Native relationship with land that talked about in the past tense. There are still Native people living here today. The Native knowledge was something from the past that is still very much in the present, if only more people took the time to look. This knowledge and the perspective is so critical to the future as well. Native people still are our neighbors and our friends, and their voices and their perspectives truly do have a critical role to play in how we collectively plan for the future.
In your book, there's a term in California, which we don't hear much here on the East Coast, called managed retreat. It sounds like it's a very controversial idea. Why is it so controversial in California, and what is it?
Yeah, and I would say managed retreat is probably controversial in Florida and any other coastal community or state that is starting this process of having these conversations about planning for the future in the face of rising water. And I think a lot of what is happening in California could offer a glimpse into a future that so many more communities around the world will be having. But, you know, managed retreat is, I would say, arguably the most controversial, most fraught term that comes up in the sea level rise space in California. I talked to at least two mayors who, one lost his job and the other one really had to pivot once the emotional backlash happened in his community. one mayor lost his job just from raising this idea in the community. But Manage Your Tree, in essence, is basically acknowledging that the ocean is rising. We are in the way of the ocean. And there's no amount of money we spend, no seawall we build is going to be big enough to protect us from the rising ocean 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years from now. So what does it mean to start proactively identifying the areas that might need to move in the future? And how do we start doing the phased, planned relocation sooner than later so that this process is fair, so that as many people as possible are protected and made whole in the process? If we're identifying neighborhoods, for example, that need to move at some point in the future, no specified date, but by naming those properties that need to move in the future because of the impending disaster, how does that affect property value? How does it affect your ability to renew your insurance? How does that affect your ability to, you know, refinance your home or buy a home and take out a 30-year mortgage if we don't know what's going to happen to this neighborhood 30 years from now? So those are kind of the sticky questions that have really just riled up a lot of people and have made this conversation about managed retreat truly a non-starter in so many communities. Retreat implies in our, at least in the American psyche, retreat feels like surrender or giving up, and it feels like failure. And manage, just like no one wants to be managed. So I have talked to a number of folks where they've said that maybe it's also just the term needs a rebranding. Yeah, it's hard because how do you help people stuck in kind of our short-term wants and needs and things like maintaining property value versus recognizing that it is wise, it is cost-efficient, it is good for a community to plan steps ahead for a different future, you know, recognizing that like inevitably the coast, our communities are going to look very different at some point in the future, given how the coastline is changing and how the water is moving in. But how do you enter that process? How do you go from the short term to the long term? How do you navigate that middle space? And how do you make it feel fair? Like those are the really tough questions that no community has really figured out. And that's where the flashpoints are. That's where the tension is. You know, we can't move forward without everyone being willing to engage with this conversation. And I think it starts by truly understanding and empathizing why change feels so insurmountable for so many people.
What do you see as the one maybe single issue that is so embedded in this crisis that really holds California back from addressing and making the necessary change in the future?
I'll just name two. When you get down to it, like what are people worried about? What are they fighting to hold on to? What are people holding on to when they want to build a seawall or when they are trying to delay a conversation about managed retreat in City Hall? It's property value. And I think as the former executive director of the California Coastal Commission, what he told me a few years ago, he's like, when you're talking about billions of dollars of real estate along some of the most valuable land in the country, this is a political issue at its core. You can't science your way out of this issue. I talked to a coastal engineer who's like, I've done all the cost-benefit analyses, I've done the life safety calculations. We've basically penciled out like the best logical, reasonable, cost-efficient, and life safety-efficient steps forward, but no one wants to hear it because that truly challenges what it is that we still want to hold on to and what we value today. One of the things that I think does call for some deep soul-searching and just recognition is that we are still beholden to these systems, whether it's economic, political, or social, like these systems that got us here in the first place. And now at what point do we recognize that we are now serving these systems that no longer are necessarily serving us? That may be too radical of a thing to say, but we're trying to hold on to property values and property lines and trying to maintain each of our own slices of paradise. But at what point do we have to recognize that? What can we do to kind of start to transition away from these mindsets and these systems that are truly not going to be arguably sustainable going into the future as the ocean continues to move inland? And then I think the other thing that kind of came to mind when you asked that question is time. In California, I will say, for the most part, I don't run into climate deniers anymore. So no one's really debating climate change, and the denial in California that they still run into so much is time. How much time do we have? And some people, a lot of people I talk to, still think this is an issue that is 70 years from now, that we don't have that. Like, a lot of this talk about managed retreat and sea level rise feels premature, and this is something for another generation to take care of. And then there are people on the other side of the issue who are like, you should have started talking about this decades ago. And the conversations that we're having today aren't moving fast enough.
So how is your relationship to the ocean? How has it changed as a result of this book?
I love that question. When I submitted my first draft of the manuscript to my editor, the first thing she said that really shook me was, the ocean is missing from this book. And I'm like, what do you mean the ocean is missing from this book? And she was like, well, we're standing on land a lot, looking out to the ocean. I really did start to think about how to think about the ocean beyond this body of water that is a threat, that is challenging our very notion of the world as we know it today. And then this notion that the ocean has a spirit, and like, what does the ocean think about all this? And what do we look like as mere humans with small buildings, puny line of asphalt in the sand? You know, what does that look like to the giant Pacific Ocean? I was focused on kind of the facts and the quotes and what people were saying, but also embedded in my notebook were all these details about what hue of blue the sky and the ocean were that day in connection to each other, whether or not the light was piercing through the marine layer, and also just the sounds of the waves and what the ocean looked like and the swells and the tide lines. And so I went from being a hardcore old school environmental journalist to someone who really understood what the genre of nature writing might be, but in a way that also honored kind of the fact that writing about nature isn't something that should be so sacred and separate from us. I guess I'm still finding my thought here, but it was a really powerful exercise to have my editor push me to bring the ocean more to life, almost as a character in the book. And through that process, my relationship to the ocean changed, or deepened, I guess would be the better word. I do hope for folks who do read the book, I hope you do feel kind of that presence and that undercurrent of just loving and respecting the spirit of the ocean that now runs throughout a lot of the book.
What do you hope people, not just on the West Coast, but everywhere, will take away with them after reading this book?
I hope this book helps start more conversations, and I hope this book helps deepen more conversations about this issue, because overall, we don't talk about climate change and how our world and our lives and are truly going to change in the coming years and decades. And so I hope this book helps people feel courage to talk about this more with their friends, with their family, with their neighbors, with their elected officials. The biggest personal moment for me in the book was just recognizing this question for me of like, how much hope do I give the reader? I realized that the emotion I should be giving the reader first and foremost is a sense of responsibility and a sense of courage, like bravery to take action and to empower. And ultimately, does the reader at the end of this book feel a sense of responsibility to do something? And that do something could be something huge if you are a person in power. And to your question earlier about how this book has been received, I've been really heartened by the number of people in power in California who have connected with this book. That do something could also be just turning to your neighbor and talking more about climate change and these questions that so many people still prefer to dance around because it's too scary or overwhelming to think about. And ultimately, the sense of responsibility to do something, to like not have this book, reading this book, be the end of your journey on this issue, that do something requires courage. What I hope for folks after reading this book is to have a sense of responsibility to this issue, to our role on this planet, to our connections to not just the ocean, but also to each other, and to have hope and to have courage that there is still something that we can do, but that we owe it to all of ourselves to not look away from the issue, even though it's the easier thing to do.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Rosanna Shaw, and that you get the opportunity to read California Against the Sea, as well as the important work she is doing at the LA Times. If you enjoyed this episode, please share with friends, family, and colleagues. If you would like to share your thoughts or comments on this or any other episode, please email me at nordenpro@gmail.com. That's Norden, NORDENPRO @gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. You can follow Nature Revisited on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and our website, nordenproductions.com. The music for Nature Revisited is Tim Buckley, Buzz and Fly. Nature Revisited is produced by Stefan Van Orden and Charles Gagan. And I hope you will join us for the next edition of Nature Revisited. And in the meantime, remember, we are nature.